Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie covering KHSC's use of AI as a diagnostic tool.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Kingston Health Sciences Center is officially the first hospital in Canada to implement a groundbreaking artificial intelligence tool used to diagnose coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is the most common form of cardiovascular disease and the leading cause of death worldwide. It occurs when the coronary arteries become narrowed or blocked, reducing blood flow to the heart. Thanks to a $100,000 donation from local donor Steven Sorensen, KHSC has introduced HeartFlow, a revolutionary AI-based technology that's transforming cardiac care. HeartFlow enables radiologists and cardiologists to measure blood flow through a patient's coronary arteries using a non-invasive CT scan. Dr. Omar Islam, head of diagnostic radiology at KHSC, explained what the diagnostic process for coronary artery disease has looked like until now.
Patients with stable chest pain typically undergo a CT scan of their heart to look at the coronary arteries, which are the blood vessels that supply oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle. And a narrowing of those blood vessels, especially severe narrowing of those blood vessels, can be significant and may be a precursor to that patient having a heart attack in the future. So those patients are typically triaged by a coronary CT angiogram to look at those blood vessels, and it's a dye that's injected into the veins, and we get a 3D map of the blood vessels. So that's how it's done. And then those patients, if they have severe narrowing on the coronary CTA, are referred potentially on to the cath lab, so the angio suite, so undergo a minor surgical procedure where that narrowing is confirmed. And if the narrowing is confirmed, then a blood flow analysis is performed, looking at the reduction in blood flow through those vessels. And reduction in blood flow is actually the most important determinant of the risk of having a heart attack. So if the blood flow is reduced, that means there's reduced delivery of oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle, and then that patient is at risk for a heart attack. So it's not really the narrowing that's most important, it's the reduction in blood flow. So we cannot assess in a typical situation the blood flow on CT. We can only assess the narrowing of the blood vessel. And so those patients typically have to be sent to the cath lab for the minor surgical procedure to look at blood flow.
Now, using the AI capabilities of HeartFlow, physicians can measure blood flow directly from a CT scan. If the flow is normal, the patient avoids an invasive procedure entirely.
Yeah, so HeartFlow is a really cool new technology. So it's a non-invasive technology that uses those CT scan images and it extrapolates blood flow from the narrowing in those blood vessels. So in essence, it gives the doctor the same information that they would otherwise need to get from the cath lab doing that minor surgical procedure. And now we get that information non-invasively from the CT scan images themselves. So it really is a one-stop shop for assessment of the coronary arteries and risk of heart disease and strokes.
For patients, this means faster answers and better care with less risk.
It's beneficial for the patients in many ways. First of all, it's non-invasive. So a cath lab is a minor surgical procedure, and patients have to come into the hospital for a day surgery, and they have to have a puncture in their groin vessels or in their arm vessels. and they have to have dye and have pictures of their heart taken under radiation. And so, you know, these procedures are performed every day throughout the country. They're extremely safe, but you know, there's still a very small risk of complications such as bleeding or stroke. And of course, no one wants to undergo an invasive procedure if they don't have to. So in, you know, up to 30% of patients, heart flow analysis avoids that patient from having to undergo that invasive angio procedure. Also, because the heart flow is applied when the patient had their CAT scan, they get the answer, the diagnosis, within a few minutes to a few hours, rather than having to wait weeks or days for the catheter procedure to occur. So they get an answer immediately, and because they get that answer right away, they can potentially get started on treatment and medications right after their CT scan with heart flow, rather than having to wait until after the results of the cath lab. Furthermore, there's less, obviously, radiation and contrast dye exposure because they're only getting a CT scan. They're not getting an angio procedure in the cath lab, so they avoid radiation and contrast dye. This is especially useful in some elderly patients or other patients who have diabetes and kidney disease, where the risk of kidney malfunction is higher with repeated contrast dye exposure. So in those patients, this test is very useful because we don't have to give the patients contrast dye twice.
This technology is also a game changer for healthcare providers and the healthcare system.
This is really, really an amazing tool from the healthcare efficiency perspective. The fact that the heart flow triages the right patients to go onwards to cath lab is really important because it reduces hospital admissions and procedure backlogs in the cath lab. There's, you know, we have long wait lists everywhere in our healthcare system. So by triaging the right patient to undergo the right test, this saves time and, of course, avoids patients from having to undergo these unnecessary procedures. Therefore, the time in the cath lab can be directed to patients who actually need to be there. It's also leads to better outcomes because of timely treatment for those who need it. And for those who don't need the procedure, heart flow provides the reassurance that their blood flow is not reduced and is not significant, and therefore they don't need to go on to further testing.
HeartFlow is now fully operational at KHSC.
So far, so good. We plan on collecting data from all the patients who undergo cardiac CT and HeartFlow analysis. We expect approximately 100 patients over the next 12 months to undergo the HeartFlow analysis. So we'll have a lot more information, coming up in the next year.
Teams at KHSC will be studying the technology's effectiveness in Canadian patients, with the goal of publishing their findings and inspiring adoption in hospitals across the country.
This technology, although it is new, it is a game changer. It works. It's been validated across multiple centers in the United States and Europe. We are fortunate to be the first site in Canada, all of Canada, to be using it. But we do hope that, our use provides recognition and is newsworthy enough so that government officials, including Ministry of Health in Ontario, take notice and realize the value in, not just for individual patients, but for the healthcare system in implementation of this technology broadly across all sites in Ontario. You know, we do feel that there's a big role for artificial intelligence in the healthcare system to work alongside the physicians, the administrators, and the staff to increase efficiencies, provide more accurate diagnosis, faster diagnosis, and improve the quality of care. We see AI as a tool that augments the care that we can provide to our patients.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about a $50,000 grant given to the town of Greater Napanee to help with emergency preparedness.
Thank you, Jesse. Ontario's Minister of Emergency Preparedness and Response, Jill Dunlop, was in Greater Dapanee last week to announce a $50,000 grant for emergency preparedness. Dunlop joined Greater Dapanee Deputy Mayor Brian Calver, Hastings, Lennox, and Addington Member of Provincial Parliament Rick Frazee, and town officials to unveil new equipment purchased through the Provincial Community Emergency Preparedness Grant, which provides funding to help communities and organizations buy emergency supplies, equipment, and services. The announcement took place next to a display featuring an emergency response trailer, cot, signage, and other preparedness items and equipment in the parking lot in front of the municipal office building at 99 Advance Avenue in Napanee. In the 2023 provincial budget, the Ontario government earmarked $110 million over 3 years to strengthen emergency preparedness in Ontario. The grants fund supplies, equipment, and services that range from $5,000 to $50,000. Minister Dunlop explained that the government grant has been used so far over the past 2 years to provide a total of $10 million to 227 municipalities, First Nations, and community organizations to improve their emergency management preparation and response. The municipality is also procuring a generator and an emergency evacuation trailer, as well as educational items such as banners, flyers, and door hangers to raise awareness about emergency preparedness. After the announcement, Greater Napanee Community Emergency Management Coordinator Erin Tyers discussed a program she is bringing to area schools to teach children about emergency preparedness so they can implement skills and make kits for their homes in case of a disaster. A part of that program will now include some of the new equipment to show kids what the essential needs are during an emergency. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the impending removal of Gananoque's King Street Bridge.
Thank you, Dinah. After months of debate and some community outcry, Gananoque is set to begin removing the King Street Pedestrian Bridge on September 2nd. The nearly century-old bridge has been closed to the public since mid-2022 due to safety concerns, and the demolition project is expected to last approximately 17 weeks. Strong Brothers Contracting will carry out the removal, with drivers and pedestrians advised to expect intermittent traffic delays and detours. The town urges everyone to follow posted signs and drive cautiously near the work zone. Updates on the project will be provided throughout construction. The bridge's removal follows a contentious vote by town council in June, when a narrow 4-3 majority approved demolition. Deputy Mayor Vicky Leakey and councillors Matt Harper, Patrick Kirkby, and David Osmond voted in favor, while Mayor John Beddoes, Anne-Marie Coyner, and Colin Brown opposed. Mayor Beddoes explored the possibility of a veto, citing potential impacts on future infrastructure funding, but legal advice confirmed he could not legally block council's decision under Ontario's strong mayor powers provisions. The vote has sparked ongoing controversy in Gananoque, with a petition to preserve the bridge gathering nearly 900 signatures. Local advocacy group Save Our King Street Pedestrian Bridge, led by John W. Taylor and Carolyn Young, has argued that repairing the bridge for pedestrian use could cost less than demolition. Tensions escalated again during an August 12th council meeting when Councillor Osmond demanded an apology from Mayor Beddoes for comments in a recent news story that he said publicly undermined council. Despite the debate, demolition contracts have been signed, and the project is moving forward, marking the end of a long and heated chapter in Gananoque's local infrastructure history.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to LJR reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the potential creation of a large-scale solar farm in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Landowners in Loyalist Township have already showed interest in a proposal brought forth by Westbridge Renewable Energy for a large-scale solar farm. The proposed project would be located on approximately 800 acres of private land near Switzerville. With a target operation date in May of 2030, the project would be capable of supplying energy to 20,000 homes. According to the township's zoning and official plan policies, Loyalist is recognized as having some of the highest photovoltaic potential in the province.
Westbridge Renewable Energy is a Canadian-based developer focused on utility-scale solar photovoltaic projects. They currently have operations in Canada, USA, the UK, and Europe. Director and Executive Chair of Westbridge Renewable Energy, Scott Kelly, explains the components of the project and what the site would look like.
Components would really be the solar PV photovoltaic panels in a rural environment, quiet, generating solar energy and clean electricity to connect to the grid and supply to the local community and industry. In terms of what it would look like, typically rows of 10-meter solar panels, some very small substations and inverters, and gravel access roads and perimeter fencing. We try to keep a fairly low, as much of a low impact as possible, and protect the local environment as much as possible. And it's very key in our site criteria and our development.
Kelly speaks about the proposed site south of the 401 near Switzerville.
This is subject to change. We're going through quite a bit of environmental and other consultation work, working with the local municipalities and trying to refine and fine-tune this.
Kelly explains how the company chooses an ideal site.
The way we look at projects and the way we would select an ideal site is obviously, is there availability on the local transmission line to add new power? And can we connect to it in an economic way and transfer and transmit the clean energy in an economical and efficient way? We look for non-prime agricultural land where there's very good solar radiance, meaning the ability to generate an excellent amount of energy that makes the project economical, where there's definite landowner interest. We see the landowners as very much as our partners, and where there is municipal and community support, and very much where we're working within the guidelines and the policies of the municipalities and the communities that we are partnering with.
Kelly notes how the company collaborates with the communities they work within.
All of our projects are very much a collaboration with the communities in which we are working with. We spend a lot of time with the municipalities, with the local landowners, working within the regulations and the environment that we're working in. Every project is unique, and we look at ourselves as long-term partners with the community and do our very best to benefit the community in every way we can.
Kelly explains how the company establishes a community benefit fund for communities they work with.
In terms of adding back to the community, it's something we very much take as part of our project. Every project that we build and plan and bring to market includes a small fund that would essentially share some of the revenue and some of the benefit and some of the funding and money that comes from this project with the local municipality.
COO and director with Westbridge Renewable Energy, Margaret McKenna, speaks about the lifespan of the project.
The typical lifespan can be kind of anywhere between 35 and 50 years, depending on whether the panels are replaced and how many times they are replaced during the life of the project. There will be a decommissioning plan. It's required as part of the renewable energy approval process. And we anticipate that there would be coordination and consultation with the Loyalist Planning Department in terms of what that looks like.
Kelly explains the timeline of their proposal and their steps going forward.
We did have a pre-consultation meeting at the end of July. We have met with several landowners. I've met with several of them personally in the last few weeks myself, and we're planning an open house just around the corner on the 25th of August at the Odessa Agricultural Society Fairground to discuss face-to-face with anyone in the community who'd like to attend. And we'll be back in September with much more finalized plans and be coming to the to the council for some support. And the final submission is October 16th.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the annual Parkinson's Canada Superwalk fundraiser.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Coburg, Ontario. Coburg is one of several locations in Canada hosting a Parkinson Canada Superwalk. The event is to raise awareness and funds for research and support. Caroline Thornton, ambassador for Parkinson Canada, is living with the non-curable disease. She is encouraging everyone to get involved.
The Superwalk is the annual fundraiser for Parkinson Canada, which raises money to provide research and support to people living with Parkinson's and their caregivers.
Okay, so let's talk about the Northumberland Walk. And part of this event that I've noticed is there's an element called the Walk in a Box Toolkit. Let's talk about that. What is it and why is that being implemented in this event?
The toolkit that we're talking about is a way for people who want to walk in that program to prepare for themselves and to get ready to go and have all of the pieces that would be necessary. So they have a registration form, they have information about the walk, they have perhaps a shirt or a t-shirt or something they can wear to promote the walk and to show that they're in the walk. It's just a way of helping people get ready and get into the walk easily, and they have a way to contact anybody if they need additional support.
What is Parkinson's disease in general?
Parkinson's is a neuromuscular degenerative disease with no cure at this time. What that means is there's a brain function that changes because of loss of dopamine, and there is muscular changes that occur throughout the disease, and they start usually as very minor tremors, and they go all the way to complete inactivity. So it's a very difficult disease to manage, and it's a very complex disease to treat. And for that reason, raising funds is critical because the research components are so important to bring new and different treatments into the marketplace. Today, the main drug that's used is called levodopa. It has been in use for 60 years, and nothing has really replaced it to date other than a tool called deep simulation brain surgery. And what that does is it puts electrodes into the brain that help to redirect or support the natural function of the brain. And so the people who get that surgery, and it's a very tiny number of people, are able to function better because their brain is, if you like, retrained to prevent further deterioration.
Now you have a lot of knowledge in this topic.
I live with it every day.
Oh, you
Dan.
Live with it. Okay, I was about to lead into that. How did you get into this, and what's your obviously you live with it. How, in your experience, how is living with Parkinson's?
Complicated. I was diagnosed in 2021, and like most people, I had no idea I had this disease. It was completely a shock to me. So the first reaction to hearing that you have the disease is usually panic, followed by anxiety, and sadly that often leads to depression. And many people who have this disease suffer from something called apathy, which is kind of a lack of willingness to live, because they've come to the conclusion there's no way to get better. I'm living a dismal life. I have no hope. I have no chance. I am just giving up right now. So that's a really big issue in this community. However, there are all kinds of wonderful tools available through Parkinson Canada, which is the national organization that supports people with this disease and their caregivers. And so people can call Parkinson Canada and get support. They can go to a local database here in Northumberland that allows them to find, for example, physiotherapists or psychologists or nutritionists or pharmacists or massage therapists. It is better for these people to work with a team. It's very hard for somebody with Parkinson's to live alone. And if they don't have a caregiver, their life is way more difficult.
So then how did you initially navigate that? You talked about the panic, you talked about the anxiety. How did you get through that? Did you get yourself set up with a team? What was your process?
I did get a team eventually, not obviously within the first week or two, nothing like that, but it took time to put a team together. But more importantly, I was in touch with one of the counselors at Parkinson Canada, and she was absolutely phenomenal in the way she helped me and supported me. I was usually in tears when we spoke because I was panicked. But she gave me all kinds of materials and guidance and support and encouragement. I call her my guardian angel. And she's still working there, and she's still very, very helpful to people who do not know what to do. The strange thing, Dan, is at that point in time, you don't even know which questions to ask. You're facing something so new and so unexpected. You don't know how to say, I need X, because you don't know what X is. You don't know how to put yourself in a place to learn when you don't know what questions to ask.
Before you got diagnosed, were there some symptoms or some things you noticed that might be off and that you needed to go to the doctor to get checked out? What went through the initial process before getting diagnosed?
Well, usually the most common way that it's diagnosed is there are tremors, and you may have seen people with tremors and they look like they're shaking and they have no control over that. And by the way, there's no pain associated with it, which is nice. But my GP said, you know, we should at least look at this and see if there's something more. And so she sent me to see a neurologist. However, the sad story in Canada is there aren't enough neurologists to treat the people who are being diagnosed. And you have to remember, this is a disease of the elderly. So the number of people who are coming down with Parkinson's, if you like, is growing rapidly. Currently in this area, it takes 2 years before you can see a neurologist. That's the wait time. Now, imagine you know or you think you might have a very serious disease that needs immediate treatment, and you have to wait 2 years to find out if that's true or not. It's absolutely horrible, but it's the truth. So there's a very big demand for neurologists, and there aren't enough here. Parkinson Canada actually now is offering scholarships and financial funding to help people studying neurology to try and get more people into the field.
How do I get involved if I want to do a walk or raise some money? How would the public get involved?
There's a website called superwalk.ca that gives you all the information you need. But in addition to that, there are people here in the community who are members of a support group, which is a group that meets monthly in Coburg to help people with Parkinson's and their caregivers. And anybody in that support group or anybody who is connected with Parkinson's in this community, including myself, because I'm an ambassador for Parkinson Canada, they are all available to help and guide and support people who want to participate on Sunday, September the 7th at 10 a.m.
So what is the goal, the fundraising goal for this walk in Northumberland?
Well, last year across Canada, there were 33 locations where the Superwalk was held, and approximately $3 million was raised across Canada on that one day of the walk. So obviously, we all try every year to try and increase the amount of funds that are available. But the truth is, you know, people are living in a different economy, and it's hard for people to come up with extra money. So we just ask people to give what they can, even if it's $5 or $10. Every single dollar matters, and everything that is generated in that walk is applied to research and developing programs that help people living with the disease.
Where is the walk taking place this year in Northumberland?
It's at the Pavilion, the Lions Pavilion, on the waterfront in Coburg.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, August 28th, daytime high of 22 degrees with periods of cloud throughout the day. Otherwise, it's going to be quite sunny. There is a 59% chance of precipitation in the forecast, however. Friday, August 29th, daytime high of 21, beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Saturday, August 30th, daytime high of 22 with a mix of sun and cloud in the forecast. Sunday, August 31st, 23 degrees, sunny and beautiful. And then moving into the start of September, Monday, September 1st, daytime high of 24, feeling closer to 25 with a mix of sun and cloud.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. As summer winds down, KPP Concerts is keeping it hot this fall with a stacked lineup of great concerts at the Broom Factory this September. On September 12th, check out Mountainhead, and then Colorado on September 14th, and Punk Icons Propaganda on September 15th. Don't miss Hamilton's The Dirty Nil on September 19th, followed by The Broke's tribute to The Strokes on September 20th. And then on September 26th, check out Petit Bellevaux and Neofolk Icons Bridge City Sinners on September 27th. The month ends with Yukon Blonde the night of September 28th at Broom Factory. All shows are co-sponsored by us here at CFRC 101.9 FM, and for a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Sangi la.
Kwe.
Why eat beef snack seal?
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negad gakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Kwe Nindeluizi Pam Palmeter. Hi, my name is Pam Palmeter, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a Mi'kmaq lawyer, professor, and author from Eel River Bar First Nation, which is known in the Mi'kmaq language as Ugbaganjig. And although my First Nation is small, we are one of many other First Nations that make up the larger Mi'kmaq Nation. And our territory is just as big. It includes all of Nova Scotia, PEI, a significant part of New Brunswick, parts of Newfoundland, parts of Quebec, and even Maine. All of that is what's known as Mi'kma'ki, Mi'kmaq territory. And have I already said it's my favorite place in the world? Today I get to talk to the super cool Mi'kmaq duo, Lindsay Denny and Alicia Sapier. Lindsay is the language and cultural coordinator for Pictou Landing First Nation in Nova Scotia. And Alicia is one of Pictou's Mi'kmaq language teachers. And she does a bunch of other cool things like create games. But when I saw their TikTok videos teaching the Mi'kmaq language, I knew I had to invite them to Words and Culture so you could hear all about their really unique and cool work. Medalotio, how are you?
We're good. I'm doing really good today.
Really? Hapnin.
Alicia, I understand that you're fluent in the language. Can you tell me a bit about what you do for the community?
Yes, I teach the language. I do language classes once a week for kids and once a week for adults. And I also started doing virtual online classes as well on Tuesdays. So if people would like to join, they can join on our Mi'kmaq Pictou Facebook page.
Wow, is that just for people who belong to Pictou?
Well, mainly our goal is because all of the reservations have their own teachers for their community, and same with us. And we have, our goal is mainly for our community, but we don't discriminate. We would love to teach as many people as we can. But because of other reservations having their own language teachers, and the difference between dialect as well would have to be something people would have to look at as well too, right? So like what we teach here might not be sounding the same as another reservation, you know?
That's so true, because I've heard a big difference. Like my reserve, Ugbaganjig Eel River Bar First Nation in New Brunswick, what the Mi'kmaq, sometimes the sayings that they have or the way they spell the language is a bit different than what I see in Nova Scotia. Do you see that too?
Yes. Okay, for example, the spelling part, I know we have the word wises. We spell W-A-I-S-I-S, but I've noticed in Elsipuktuk, they spell it W-I-S-I-S. So there's an example of a spelling. And another example for the speech part. For basement, for downstairs, the big cove, they would say ebuneg. But for us, we say goeg. And like another example would be store. Big Covers will say Magusang. We say Masunogon. So there's that difference in the dialects, right?
I wonder how much of an influence French has had on the language, because magasin is the word for store in French. And so the word they used in El Sebuktuk or Big Cove sounds very close to the French word.
There's a lot of French influence in our language, actually. One example would be plate. Some people will call it deptahan, or another way to say it is l'assiette. And that's almost like a French.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another thing the French do influence is, okay, so one example is we have moose, right? Mm-hmm. And when the French people came, they had cows. So when the French brought their cows, we call them wenjidiam, the French moose. Wenj, like the French, wenj, and moose, wenjidiam. So it's a French moose.
I didn't know that.
Yes. So there's another influence. Shoes, I hear, is another influence because they're called wenjusanang. The French people brought them, wenj, wenjusanang.
Okay, all right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I always wonder, because I'm not fluent. I know very little Mi'kmaq, but when I worked in the federal government, I had to become bilingual in French and learn French, you know, for the first time. And then I was like, wait a second. I think I recognize some of these words in Mi'kmaq. I was surprised at the number of Mi'kmaq words that I heard that resembled French words for the same thing. So you're a Mi'kmaq language teacher, which is so amazing. Thank you for that work that you do. When I was reading your bio, it said that you do, like, you create resources and you even design games. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm working on a Jenga game, conversational Jenga, and that would be like a little board that goes, going to be, you know how you get your Jenga, but you're going to be able to have three different colors to make three different sentences using the Jenga, like that. Like I come up with little ideas like that.
I love that, because you as, you know, language instructors and educators and people who are dedicated to cultural revitalization, we all know that the best way to cement learning is, you know, not just practice and auditory, but visual, but it's also like active. So playing games would also help cement that. And I think that's such a good idea. I didn't even know that there was people out there doing that. Like, I heard that there's people out there trying to make like video games or whatever. I'm not very good at video games, but I could do these other ones. And Lindsay, like, I heard you describe yourself on one of the TikToks as a Mi'kmaq language learner because you're not yet fluent. What inspired you to take up the role as language and cultural coordinator? Is it because you were on this journey?
So growing up, I didn't hear much of the language around me. And once I became a mom, I realized how important it was for me to reconnect so I could pass it on to my son. He's two. And that really pushed me to learn and get involved in revitalizing the language here in our community. Because a lot of people my age, so I'm 31, and a lot of us grew up not speaking the language. So it was really important to me to try and learn and get that back, right? Because it's such a beautiful language, and I really, really wish I could speak it. But I'm learning new words each day and practicing as much as I can.
Well, that's inspiring for me, because I think about, you know, there's a generation or two of us who didn't learn the language. Like, even though my grandmother and my family and my father, when they were all living on the res and he was younger, they were all, that's their first language. That was the only language they knew. But then, you know, when, you know, everything that happened in society and with the government and colonization, he was like, don't speak the language. You're not going to learn the language. I couldn't pass it on to my kids. They're in their 30s now. But now that I have baby grandkids, I want to do nothing more than to keep learning, like, because I've been on a slow journey. And I'm just thinking, thank goodness there are people like you two out there making it fun and interesting and non-intimidating. You make it welcoming and inviting. And do you think that makes a huge difference in whether people feel brave enough to come in into a language class?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as a learner myself, it's been a slow but meaningful journey. And, you know, we just want to help others, and we want to create a safe space for learners. And, you know, we want to make language fun, accessible. But yeah, I feel like that's definitely made a difference.
I had no choice. Growing up as a kid, my family would get upset if they were to hear me speak a word of English. I would be smacked across the head. Or told, get the heck out of my house. You're going to speak that language in here. Dali, they'll be like, Dali Sinda Abu Gagil. I don't understand you. Manastumno, Dali Singil. If I were to speak English, they'll be like, what are you speaking? I don't understand you. So that's how I was able to hold my language. My family wouldn't allow. I'm 41 years old. My family did not allow me to speak English in the home at all whatsoever. My Bloj family, my Google family, yeah, they speak terrible English. That's the only reason why I have my fluency. It's because of them. And then plus, I grew up with it in school as well, right? My teachers were Mi'kmaq. My mom's Mi'kmaq. So I had no choice.
I can't even imagine what it would have been like to grow up only speaking Mi'kmaq. Imagine getting into trouble for speaking English. That's some hardcore resistance on the colonial push to wipe out our languages. And I don't know if this Mi'kmaq musician grew up speaking his language, but I certainly know he can sing it. Check out Morgan Tony with the Mi'kmaq Honor Song. Songwriter Morgan Tony with the Mi'kmaq Honor Song. What I really love is that it's the two of you with very different experiences and in different positions, one fluent, one not, one who grew up with it, one who didn't. And you're both trying to teach the Mi'kmaq language to other people who are in a variety of these similar situations. And that means a lot to people like me, that there are people out there that are doing this and trying to reach us in a different way. And one of those things, Lindsay, I always wanted to ask, because, you know, I love your TikToks. I think you both are a hoot. Mm-hmm. I look forward to your TikToks every morning, especially the one that you did on the bloopers. Every blooper, every cut made me laugh harder. And I was like, I'm going to pee my pants. This is...
What's the way go?
Questions before I go on from here. Great. I really understood that well.
One. Gwe.
And Alicia, I have to ask you, How do you keep a straight face during some of these things? Because I am dying. I mean, how do you do it?
I just got to shake it off and turn around for a split second while it's still there.
Okay, well, Lindsay, are you kind of the video director of all these TikToks?
Yes. Yeah, so coming into this role as a non-speaker and a learner, I was like, what can I bring to the table to help with language revitalization? And I was like, you know what? Because we were having a hard time. The first thing we did was do language classes, right? Because that's what the community wanted. We did put out a survey and we presented it at the AGA in our community here back in November, where we asked community members, you know, what did they want? And a lot of them did say they wanted language classes, online resources, apps, one-on-one sessions, language video. So I was like, perfect. That's what I'm going to take control of, because I was already on TikTok beforehand and none of my coworkers were really familiar with social media and TikTok. So I was like, you know what? I'll start creating videos. And
when I was a nervous wreck.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh my God. Yes. That first
time. We believe that language is a key component of identity, and revitalizing it strengthens the community's connections to its culture. It promotes pride and it ensures that future generations understand and appreciate their cultural roots. Glusuahan Mingnu Wijit Giskuk. Which means Mi'kmaq word of the day. And the Mi'kmaq word of the day is Giptigewigus, which translates to frost moon. And in the Mi'kmaq calendar, Giptigewigus is the moon that corresponds to the time when rivers begin to freeze over.
Yeah, her growth as we did each video, like she was really shy in the beginning, but you know, she got more comfortable as we posted each video. That's why I took on that role, was because that's what I was good at, was editing TikTok. And it's been really fun.
It's so good. Like, what made you think to use TikTok to teach Mi'kmaq? Were you trying to target like the younger generation, or was it just because native TikTok is on TikTok? Like, what made you think to use TikTok versus, say, YouTube, a big long video on YouTube?
So when I was initially hired, I was actually initially hired as the youth mentor. So my focus was on the youth, and, they're on TikTok, and I wanted to make language fun, accessible. And I find now we have a shorter attention span. So I wanted to make our videos really quick, but also gain a lot from just that short segment of language. So we're working on commands right now. So we need to recruit more people for our video. So that's how we got. So some of them were a little bit uncomfortable filming, but I'm so glad we finally got them on camera, because they're like, there's no way I'm ever going on TikTok. You are not going to record me. And I'm like, you know what? Okay, fine. I respect that. But yeah, they got more comfortable with it and were able to be in our videos, and it's awesome.
And that's our future plan, is to have the whole community members involved in making our videos sometime in the near future too, right?
Yes, so, absolutely.
Like the other day, we needed another person for a video here. We didn't have it. So I had to go down to the gym, and we had Sabrina volunteer. I said, we need a person. Anyone here not busy can come help us? Sabrina's like, okay. So she came in and helped us, right?
Yeah, and
so,
she's a community member.
Yeah, so. She's from here.
Yeah, so it was great.
Yeah. Well, what I really appreciate about it is it's not all formal and stuffy and like what you would expect if it was like, say, a university class, and it's just so serious. Like the fact that you can make mistakes, or someone's trying not to laugh, or you're doing it over again, or they're walking in very awkward. It's like, this is so much fun. It makes me want to learn all of that stuff. And Alicia, one thing I wanted to ask you, some of the things you share on these TikToks is the different forms of a word. If it's you know, a command for one person or two people or three people. Can you just give us an example and what the difference is between those three words? Like if it was to, you know, get out of here or come back or sit down or whatever, but what the difference is when it's one person, two people, three people.
Yeah, they're kind of like pronouns, neen, gil, negum. So one is like, one neen is me, or like you, gil, like would be you, or negum would be them, right? So that's what I'm trying to teach people, the difference between like, between neen and Lindsay, Grinia, Daluisin.
Daluisi, Lindsay.
And I would say like, Daluisid. That would mean like, what's their name? So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the one between me and her, and then there's the one between them.
That's amazing. And because there's things that I forget from taking, I think it was Peggy Clement from Elsa Booktok who had taught me like years and years ago, and that they're like, it's the same word, but it takes a different form if you're commanding one person to do it versus two people to do it. And I always thought that's so interesting because you know how just generally in our community, sometimes we just use the same word. Like I used to always say, Wallalan, whether I'm saying Wallalan to one person or whether it was to a room of people or six people. And then an elder said, well, actually, there's a difference if it's one person or another person. So Alicia, what is the difference? Like for any listeners who don't know the difference, when you hear someone say, well, Alan, they
I
know
have
that.
A great example. Actually, I have a really great example. Something my kid's father would do. He would tell me, oh, your Nidab is here. Your Nidab is here. And I'm like, my Nidab? No. Yes, it's my friend, but you're supposed to say your Gidab is here. Cause so Nidab, my friend, Gidab, your friend, Widab, their friend. So he would always tell me, your Nidab is here. And I'm like, no, you're supposed to say your Gidab is here. Your friend is here. So there's that Neen, Gil, Negum.
Okay, so in the context of, say, Wallalan, I'm saying that to one person, but if I'm saying it to, say, six people, thanking all of them, what would be the word?
Wallalio.
It's one person saying it to two or more people.
Yeah.
Okay, what if it was a family, our family is thanking another family?
Wallaliag.
Like, thank you from us.
Yeah, thank you from us. Like, if I was to thank all you guys from us, Wallalieg.
Okay. So, Wallalan, Wallalio, Wallalieg.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's how we usually finish our TikTok videos. Yeah.
Like, I know sometimes it's easier to learn a language if you're in it. Like, if, say, you're living in a community or in a family and you're immersion, I guess, fully immersed in it, and you just kind of have to learn it trial by fire. But do you think that people who don't have an opportunity to be fully immersed in the language can still learn it enough to, say, be conversational or understand people?
Almost definitely. I believe you can, because there are single phrases that you can say. You don't have, like, even just the smallest amount of Mi'kmaq you can speak is, I would say, would be a great, great improvement. Because any little bit of Mi'kmaq you know is great. And start small. Just say, thank you, Wallalin, Namultis, Midaulain, Gesalol. Like, those simple words, they're meaningful. Like, Gesalol, I love you. Like, my son, he works here at the store, and he says, Wallalin, Namultis. And when I walk in there, he tells me that, all right, Namultis, Mom, Gesalol. Like, you know, simple little phrases. And that's where it can start.
Okay, well, I want to ask both of you, for Mi'kmaq youth, say, whether they live on reserve or off reserve, what is your message to them about the language? And, like, say, assume that they're non-fluent and they really want to learn the language. What's your advice or guidance for them about what they could do?
Don't be shy. Do your best. We're here to help. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to make fun of people myself. I know that discourages people, so I do my best. Just be proud of your language and you'll be able to learn it easily. Yeah. Repetition. Don't forget.
Be proud of who you are.
Yes.
Yeah. And every word matters.
Yeah. Even if you can't speak a full sentence, if you can just say one simple, like, Gesalul, I love you, you know, that's phrase right there, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, we'll just be walking around everywhere. Gesalul.
Gesalul, numultes. Like, see you again.
Yeah.
That was Lindsay Denny and Alicia Sapier from Pictou Landing First Nation Mi'kmaq Language Team. Be sure to follow them on TikTok as PLFN Language Team. They left us with some very important advice. Don't be shy. Do your best. Be proud of your language. Be proud of who you are. And every word matters. What an incredible way to end this Mi'kmaq language series on words and culture. Actually, I don't want this series to end. Hey, producer, can we just keep this going? Here I thought I was just going to host another show, but instead, I've been educated, empowered, and inspired to continue on with my own Mi'kmaq language learning journey. Everyone I've had the honor to talk to, Jarvis Gugu, Michelle Sillaboy, Jeremy Dutcher, Cheryl Maloney, Bernie Francis, and in this final episode, Lindsay Denny and Alicia Sapier. Every single one of them taught me something new. But they all had something in common. Not only did they all encourage me to continue learning the language of our ancestors, but they all agreed it can be done. I can become fluent and pass it on to my grandkids. They also taught me that the cultural context of our language is just as important as the words themselves. They also taught me that it's not our fault if we are not fluent in our traditional indigenous languages. Colonial laws, policies, and practices over hundreds of years worked really hard to erase us, our cultures, and our languages. But guess what? We're still here. We're still speaking our languages, and we're inspiring others to join us on that journey to learn our languages, the languages of our ancestors. And for me, that's Mi'kmaq. Next time on Words and Culture, I'm handing it over to legendary broadcaster, the incredible Sheila Rogers. Sheila will be bringing you all things Métis and talk about her own journey about connecting to her culture and language. Kualalio ohodetut. Thank you, friends, for listening and supporting Words and Culture. I'm your host, Pam Palmiter. Namultis. See you again.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Maltis.
Ninuis Ahaha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachunautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
Queen's Parkinson's Kingston is a student-led club dedicated to raising awareness, fundraising, and supporting those affected by Parkinson's disease in both the Queens and Kingston communities. On September 6th, join Queen's Parkinson's Kingston for the 2025 Parkinson Canada Super Walk, taking place at Lake Ontario Park and running from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Learn more by reaching out to QPK at clubs.queensu.ca and following Queen's Parkinson's Kingston at queens4pd.kingston on Instagram.
On Saturday, August 30th, the Gaels roll into Hamilton for a Steel City showdown against the McMaster Marauders. Can the Gaels bounce back from a home heartbreaker to pick up their first win of the season? Or will the Marauders plunder and pillage their way to victory? There's only one way to find out, and there's only one place to catch all the action. Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 12:45 p.m. for the Grad Club pregame show ahead of the scheduled 1 p.m. kickoff. Gales Game Day on CFRC, over a century of excellence.
Hi, my name is Corey, and I am one of the managing editors of Quilt, a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queen's. Right now, we are hiring for our 2025-2026 team, and I want to invite you to apply. We're looking for undergraduate students for our financial team, event planners, illustrators and layout designers, editorial board, copy editors, and outreach team. We are also seeking grad student advisors to work alongside the editorial board. To find more information and the link to apply, go to our Instagram.